This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. Read by the author, Elizabeth Gilbert. Question: What is creativity? Answer: The relationship between a human being and the mysteries of inspiration. Part 1. Courage. Hidden Treasure. Once upon a time, there was a man named Jack Gilbert, who was not related to me, unfortunately for me. Jack Gilbert was a great poet, but if you've never heard of him, don't worry about it. It's not your fault. He never much cared about being known. But I knew about him, and I loved him dearly, from a respectful distance, so let me tell you about him. Jack Gilbert was born in Pittsburgh in 1925, and grew up in the midst of that city's smoke, noise, and industry. He worked in factories and steel mills as a young man, but was called from an early age to write poetry. He answered the call without hesitation. He became a poet the way other men become monks, as a devotional practice, as an act of love, and as a lifelong commitment to the search for grace and transcendence. I think this is probably a very good way to become a poet, or to become anything, really, that calls to your heart and brings you to life. Jack could have been famous, but he wasn't into it. He had the talent and the charisma for fame, but he never had the interest. His first collection, published in 1962, won the prestigious Yale Younger Poets Prize and was nominated for the Pulitzer. What's more, he won over audiences as well as critics, which is not an easy feat for a poet in the modern world. There was something about him that drew people in and kept them captivated. He was handsome, passionate, sexy, brilliant on stage. He was a magnet for women and an idol for men. He was photographed for Vogue, looking gorgeous and romantic. People were crazy about him. He could have been a rock star. Instead, he disappeared. He didn't want to be distracted by too much commotion. Later in life, he reported that he had found his fame boring, not because it was immoral or corrupting, but simply because it was exactly the same thing every day. He was looking for something richer, more textured, more varied. So he dropped out. He went to live in Europe and stayed there for 20 years. He lived for a while in Italy, a while in Denmark, but mostly he lived in a shepherd's hut on a mountaintop in Greece. There, he contemplated the eternal mysteries, watched the light change, and wrote his poems in private. He had his love stories, his obstacles, his victories. He was happy. He got by somehow, making a living here and there. He needed little. He allowed his name to be forgotten. After 2 decades, Jack Gilbert resurfaced and published another collection of poems. Again, the literary world fell in love with him. Again, he could have been famous. Again, he disappeared. This time, for a decade. This would be his pattern always. Isolation, followed by the publication of something sublime, followed by more isolation. He was like a rare orchid with blooms separated by many years. He never promoted himself in the least. In one of the few interviews he ever gave, Gilbert was asked how he thought his detachment from the publishing world had affected his career. He laughed and said, "I suppose it's been fatal." The only reason I ever heard of Jack Gilbert was that quite late in his life, he returned to America and, for motives I will never know, took a temporary teaching position in the creative writing department at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. The following year, 2005, it happened that I took exactly the same job. Around campus, they started jokingly calling the position the Gilbert Chair. I found Jack Gilbert's books in my office, the office that had once been his. It was almost like the room was still warm from his presence. I read his poems and was overcome by their grandeur and by how much his writing reminded me of Whitman. "We must risk delight," he wrote. "We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world." He and I had the same surname, we'd held the same job, we had inhabited the same office, we had taught many of the same students, and now I was in love with his words. Naturally enough, I became deeply curious about him. I asked around, who was Jack Gilbert? Students told me he was the most extraordinary man they'd ever encountered. He had seemed not quite of this world, they said. He seemed to live in a state of uninterrupted marvel, and he encouraged them to do the same. He didn't so much teach them how to write poetry, they said, but why, because of delight, because of stubborn gladness. He told them that they must live their most creative lives as a means of fighting back against the ruthless furnace of this world. Most of all, though, he asked his students to be brave. Without bravery, he instructed, they would never be able to realize the vaulting scope of their own capacities. Without bravery, they would never know the world as richly as it longs to be known. Without bravery, their lives would remain small, far smaller than they probably wanted their lives to be. I never met Jack Gilbert myself, and now he is gone. He passed away in 2012. I probably could have made it a personal mission to seek him out and meet him while he was still living, but I never really wanted to. Experience has taught me to be careful of meeting my heroes in person. It can be terribly disappointing. Anyway, I quite liked the way he lived inside my imagination as a massive and powerful presence, built out of his poems and the stories I'd heard about him. So I decided to know him only that way, through my imagination. And that's where he remains for me to this day, still alive inside me, completely internalized, almost as though I dreamed him up. But I will never forget what the real Jack Gilbert told somebody else, an actual flesh and blood person, a shy University of Tennessee student. This young woman recounted to me that one afternoon, after his poetry class, Jack had taken her aside. He complimented her work, then asked her what she wanted to do with her life. Hesitantly, she admitted that perhaps she wanted to be a writer. He smiled at the girl with infinite compassion and asked, "Do you have the courage? Do you have the courage to bring forth this work? The treasures that are hidden inside you are hoping you will say yes." Creative living defined. So this, I believe, is the central question upon which all creative living hinges. Do you have the courage to bring forth the treasures that are hidden within you? Look, I don't know what's hidden within you. I have no way of knowing such a thing. You yourself may barely know, although I suspect you've caught glimpses. I don't know your capacities, your aspirations, your longings, your secret talents, but surely something wonderful is sheltered inside you. I say this with all confidence because I happen to believe that we are all walking repositories of buried treasure. I believe this is one of the oldest and most generous tricks the universe plays on us human beings, both for its own amusement and for ours. The universe buries strange jewels deep within us all, and then stands back to see if we can ever find them. The hunt to uncover those jewels, that's creative living. The courage to go on that hunt in the first place, that's what separates a mundane existence from a more enchanted one. The often surprising results of that hunt, that's what I call big magic. An amplified existence. When I talk about creative living here, please understand that I am not necessarily talking about pursuing a life that is professionally or exclusively devoted to the arts. I'm not saying that you must become a poet who lives on a mountaintop in Greece, or that you must perform at Carnegie Hall, or that you must win the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, though if you want to attempt any of these feats, by all means, have at it. I love watching people swing for the bleachers. No, when I refer to creative living, I'm speaking more broadly. I'm talking about living a life that is driven more strongly by curiosity than by fear. One of the coolest examples of creative living that I've seen in recent years, for instance, came from my friend Susan, who took up figure skating when she was 40 years old. To be more precise, she actually already knew how to skate. She had competed in figure skating as a child and had always loved it, but she'd quit the sport during adolescence when it became clear that she didn't have quite enough talent to be a champion. Ah, lovely adolescence, when the talented are officially shunted off from the herd, thus putting the total burden of society's creative dreams on the thin shoulders of a few select souls, while condemning everyone else to live a more commonplace, inspiration-free existence. What a system. For the next quarter of a century, my friend Susan did not skate. Why bother if you can't be the best? Then she turned 40. She was listless. She was restless. She felt drab and heavy. She did a little soul-searching the way one does on the big birthdays. She asked herself when was the last time she'd felt truly light, joyous, and yes, creative in her own skin. To her shock, she realized it had been decades since she'd felt that way. In fact, the last time she'd experienced such feelings had been as a teenager, back when she was still figure skating. She was appalled to discover that she had denied herself this life-affirming pursuit for so long, and she was curious to see if she still loved it. So she followed her curiosity. She bought a pair of skates, found a rink, hired a coach. She ignored the voice within her that told her she was being self-indulgent and preposterous to do this crazy thing. She tamped down her feelings of extreme self-consciousness at being the only middle-aged woman on the ice with all those tiny, feathery 9-year-old girls. She just did it. 3 mornings a week, Susan awoke before dawn, and in that groggy hour before her demanding day job began, she skated, and she skated and skated and skated. And yes, she loved it as much as ever. She loved it even more than ever, perhaps, because now, as an adult, she finally had the perspective to appreciate the value of her own joy. Skating made her feel alive and ageless. She stopped feeling like she was nothing more than a consumer, nothing more than the sum of her daily obligations and duties. She was making something of herself, making something with herself. It was a revolution, a literal revolution, as she spun to life again on the ice, revolution upon revolution upon revolution. Please note that my friend did not quit her job, did not sell her home, did not sever all her relationships and move to Toronto to study 70 hours a week with an exacting Olympic-level skating coach. And no, this story does not end with her winning any championship medals. It doesn't have to. In fact, this story does not end at all, because Susan is still figure skating several mornings a week, simply because skating is still the best way for her to unfold a certain beauty and transcendence within her life that she cannot seem to access in any other manner. And she would like to spend as much time as possible in such a state of transcendence while she's still here on Earth. That's all. That's what I call creative living. And while the paths and outcomes of creative living will vary wildly from person to person, I can guarantee you this. A creative life is an amplified life. It's a bigger life, a happier life, an expanded life, and a hell of a lot more interesting life. Living in this manner, continually and stubbornly bringing forth the jewels that are hidden within you, is a fine art in and of itself. Because creative living is where big magic will always abide. Scary, scary, scary. Let's talk about courage now. If you already have the courage to bring forth the jewels that are hidden within you, terrific. You're probably already doing really interesting things with your life, and you don't need this book. Rock on. But if you don't have the courage, let's try to get you some. Because creative living is a path for the brave. We all know this. And we all know that when courage dies, creativity dies with it. We all know that fear is a desolate boneyard where our dreams go to desiccate in the hot sun. This is common knowledge. Sometimes we just don't know what to do about it. Let me list for you some of the many ways in which you might be afraid to live a more creative life. You're afraid you have no talent. You're afraid you'll be rejected or criticized or ridiculed or misunderstood or, worst of all, ignored. You're afraid there's no market for your creativity and therefore no point in pursuing it. You're afraid somebody else already did it better. You're afraid everybody else already did it better. You're afraid somebody will steal your ideas so it's safer to keep them hidden forever in the dark. You're afraid you won't be taken seriously. You're afraid your work isn't politically, emotionally, or artistically important enough to change anyone's life. You're afraid your dreams are embarrassing. You're afraid that someday you'll look back on your creative endeavors as having been a giant waste of time, effort, and money. You're afraid you don't have the right kind of discipline. You're afraid you don't have the right kind of workspace or financial freedom or empty hours in which to focus on invention or exploration. You're afraid you don't have the right kind of training or degree. You're afraid you're too fat. I don't know what this has to do with creativity exactly, but experience has taught me that most of us are afraid we're too fat, so let's just put that on the anxiety list for good measure. You're afraid of being exposed as a hack or a fool or a dilettante or a narcissist. You're afraid of upsetting your family with what you may reveal. You're afraid of what your peers and coworkers will say if you express your personal truth aloud. You're afraid of unleashing your innermost demons, and you really don't want to encounter your innermost demons. You're afraid your best work is behind you. You're afraid you never had any best work to begin with. You're afraid you neglected your creativity for so long that now you can never get it back. You're afraid you're too old to start. You're afraid you're too young to start. You're afraid because something went well in your life once, so obviously nothing can ever go well again. You're afraid because nothing has ever gone well in your life, so why bother trying? You're afraid of being a one-hit wonder. You're afraid of being a no-hit wonder. Listen, I don't have all day here, so I'm not going to just keep listing fears. It's a bottomless list anyhow, and a depressing one. I'll just wrap up my summary this way. Scary, scary, scary. Everything is so goddamn scary. Defending your weakness. Please understand that the only reason I can speak so authoritatively about fear is that I know it so intimately. I know every inch of fear from head to toe. I've been a frightened person my entire life. I was born terrified. I'm not exaggerating. You can ask anyone in my family and they'll confirm that yes, I was an exceptionally freaked out child. My earliest memories are of fear, as are pretty much all the memories that come after my earliest memories. Growing up, I was afraid not only of all the commonly recognized and legitimate childhood dangers, the dark, strangers, the deep end of the swimming pool, but I was also afraid of an extensive list of completely benign things: snow, perfectly nice babysitters, cars, playgrounds, stairs, Sesame Street, the telephone, board games, the grocery store, sharp blades of grass, any new situation whatsoever, anything that dared to move, etc., etc., etc. I was a sensitive and easily traumatized creature who would fall into fits of weeping at any disturbance in her force field. My father, exasperated, used to call me Pitiful Pearl. We went to the Delaware Shore one summer when I was 8 years old, and the ocean upset me so much that I tried to get my parents to stop all the people on the beach from going into the surf. I just would have felt a lot more comfortable if everyone had stayed safely on his or her own towel, quietly reading. Was that too much to ask? If I'd had my way, I would have spent that entire vacation, indeed my entire childhood, indoors, snuggled on my mother's lap in low light, preferably with a cool washcloth on my forehead. This is a horrible thing to say, but here goes. I probably would have loved having one of those awful Munchausen syndrome by proxy mothers who could have colluded with me in pretending that I was eternally sick, weak, and dying. I would have totally cooperated with that kind of mother in creating a completely helpless child, given half the chance. But I didn't get that kind of mother. Not even close. Instead, I got a mother who wasn't having it. She wasn't having a minute of my drama, which is probably the luckiest thing that ever happened to me. My mom grew up on a farm in Minnesota, the proud product of tough Scandinavian immigrants, and she was not about to raise a little candy ass. Not on her watch. My mother had a plan for turning around my fear that was almost comic in its straightforwardness. At every turn, she made me do exactly what I dreaded most. Scared of the ocean? Get in that ocean. Afraid of the snow? Time to go shovel snow. Can't answer the telephone? You are now officially in charge of answering the telephone in this house. Hers was not a sophisticated strategy, but it was consistent. Trust me, I resisted her. I cried and sulked and deliberately failed. I refused to thrive. I lagged behind, limping and trembling. I would do almost anything to prove that I was emotionally and physically totally enfeebled. To which my mom was like, "No, you aren't." I spent years pushing back against my mother's unshakable faith in my strength and abilities. Then, one day, somewhere in adolescence, I finally realized that this was a really weird battle for me to be fighting. Defending my weakness? That's seriously the hill I wanted to die on? As the saying goes, argue for your limitations and you get to keep them. Why would I want to keep my limitations? I didn't, as it turned out. I don't want you keeping yours either. Fear is boring. Over the years, I've often wondered what finally made me stop playing the role of Pitiful Pearl, almost overnight. Surely there were many factors involved in that evolution, the tough mom factor, the growing up factor, but mostly I think it was just this. I finally realized that my fear was boring. Mind you, My fear had always been boring to everybody else, but it wasn't until mid-adolescence that it became, at last, boring even to me. My fear became boring to me, I believe, for the same reason that fame became boring to Jack Gilbert, because it was the same thing every day. Around the age of 15, I somehow figured out that my fear had no variety to it, no depth, no substance, no texture. I noticed that my fear never changed, never delighted, never offered a surprise twist or an unexpected ending. My fear was a song with only one note, only one word, actually, and that word was stop. My fear never had anything more interesting or subtle to offer than that one emphatic word, repeated at full volume on an endless loop, stop, 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 stop. Which means that my fear always made predictably boring decisions, like a choose-your-own-ending book that always had the same ending, nothingness. I also realized that my fear was boring because it was identical to everybody else's fear. I figured out that everyone's song of fear has exactly that same tedious lyric, stop, 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 stop. True, the volume may vary from person to person, but the song itself never changes, because all of us humans were equipped with the same basic fear package when we were being knitted in our mother's wombs. And not just humans. If you pass your hand over a petri dish containing a tadpole, the tadpole will flinch beneath your shadow. That tadpole cannot write poetry, and it cannot sing, and it will never know love or jealousy or triumph, and it has a brain the size of a punctuation mark, but it damn sure knows how to be afraid of the unknown. Well, so do I. So do we all. But there's nothing particularly compelling about that, do you see what I mean? You don't get any special credit, is what I'm saying, for knowing how to be afraid of the unknown. Fear is a deeply ancient instinct, in other words, and it's an evolutionarily vital one, but it ain't especially smart. For the entirety of my young and skittish life, I had fixated upon my fear as if it were the most interesting thing about me, when actually it was the most mundane. In fact, my fear was probably the only 100% mundane thing about me. I had creativity within me that was original. I had a personality within me that was original. I had dreams and perspectives and aspirations within me that were original. But my fear was not original in the least. My fear wasn't some kind of rare artisanal object. It was just a mass-produced item available on the shelves of any generic box store. And that's the thing I wanted to build my entire identity around. The most boring instinct I possessed? The panic reflex of my dumbest inner tadpole? No. The fear you need and the fear you don't need. Now you probably think I'm going to tell you that you must become fearless in order to live a more creative life. But I'm not going to tell you that, because I don't happen to believe it's true. Creativity is a path for the brave, yes, but it is not a path for the fearless, and it's important to recognize the distinction. Bravery means doing something scary. Fearlessness means not even understanding what the word scary means. If your goal in life is to become fearless, then I believe you're already on the wrong path. Because the only truly fearless people I've ever met were straight-up sociopaths and a few exceptionally reckless three-year-olds, and those aren't good role models for anyone. The truth is, you need your fear, for obvious reasons of basic survival. Evolution did well to install a fear reflex within you, because if you didn't have any fear, you would lead a short, crazy, stupid life. You would walk into traffic. You would drift off into the woods and be eaten by bears. You would jump into giant waves off the coast of Hawaii despite being a poor swimmer. You would marry a guy who said on the first date, "I don't necessarily believe people were designed by nature to be monogamous." So yes, you absolutely do need your fear in order to protect you from actual dangers like the ones I've just listed. But you do not need your fear in the realm of creative expression. Seriously, you don't. Just because you don't need your fear when it comes to creativity, of course, doesn't mean that your fear won't show up. Trust me, your fear will always show up, especially when you're trying to be inventive or innovative. Your fear will always be triggered by your creativity, because creativity asks you to enter into realms of uncertain outcome, and fear hates uncertain outcome. Your fear, programmed by evolution to be hypervigilant and insanely overprotective, will always assume that any uncertain outcome is destined to end in a bloody, horrible death. Basically, your fear is like a mall cop who thinks he's a Navy SEAL. He hasn't slept in days, he's all hopped up on Red Bull, and he's liable to shoot at his own shadow in an absurd effort to keep everyone safe. This is all totally natural and human. It's absolutely nothing to be ashamed of. It is, however, something that very much needs to be dealt with. The road trip. Here's how I learned to deal with my fear. I made a decision a long time ago that if I want creativity in my life, and I do, then I will have to make space for fear, too. Plenty of space. I decided that I would need to build an expansive enough interior life that my fear and my creativity could peacefully coexist, since it appeared that they would always be together. In fact, it seems to me that my fear and my creativity are basically conjoined twins, as evidenced by the fact that creativity cannot take a single step forward without fear marching right alongside it. Fear and creativity shared a womb, they were born at the same time, and they still share some vital organs. This is why we have to be careful of how we handle our fear, because I've noticed that when people try to kill off their fear, they often end up inadvertently murdering their creativity in the process. So I don't try to kill off my fear. I don't go to war against it. Instead, I make all that space for it, heaps of space, every single day. I'm making space for fear right this moment. I allow my fear to live and breathe and stretch out its legs comfortably. It seems to me that the less I fight my fear, the less it fights back. If I can relax, fear relaxes too. In fact, I cordially invite fear to come along with me everywhere I go. I even have a welcoming speech prepared for fear, which I deliver right before embarking on any new project or big adventure. It goes something like this. Dearest fear, creativity and I are about to go on a road trip together. I understand you'll be joining us, because you always do. I acknowledge that you believe you have an important job to do in my life and that you take your job seriously. Apparently your job is to induce complete panic whenever I'm about to do anything interesting, and may I say you are superb at your job. So by all means, keep doing your job if you feel you must. But I will also be doing my job on this road trip, which is to work hard and stay focused. And creativity will be doing its job, which is to remain stimulating and inspiring. There's plenty of room in this vehicle for all of us, so make yourself at home. But understand this, creativity and I are the only ones who will be making any decisions along the way. I recognize and respect that you are part of this family, so I will never exclude you from our activities. But still, your suggestions will never be followed. You're allowed to have a seat, and you're allowed to have a voice, but you are not allowed to have a vote. You're not allowed to touch the roadmaps, you're not allowed to suggest detours, you're not allowed to fiddle with the temperature. Dude, you are not even allowed to touch the radio. But above all else, my dear old familiar friend, you are absolutely forbidden to drive. Then we head off together, me and creativity and fear, side by side by side forever, advancing once more into the terrifying but marvelous terrain of unknown outcome. Why it's worth it. It isn't always comfortable or easy carrying your fear around with you on your great and ambitious road trip, But it's always worth it, because if you can't learn to travel comfortably alongside your fear, then you'll never be able to go anywhere interesting or do anything interesting. And that would be a pity, because your life is short and rare and amazing and miraculous, and you want to do really interesting things and make really interesting things while you're still here. I know that's what you want for yourself, because that's what I want for myself, too. It's what we all want. And you have treasures hidden within you, extraordinary treasures, and so do I, and so does everyone around us. And bringing those treasures to light takes work and faith and focus and courage and hours of devotion, and the clock is ticking, and the world is spinning, and we simply do not have time anymore to think so small. Part 2. Enchantment. An idea arrives. Now that we're done talking about fear, we can finally talk about magic. Let me begin by telling you the most magical thing that's ever happened to me. It's about a book that I failed to write. My tale begins in the early spring of 2006. I had recently published Eat, Pray, Love, and I was trying to figure out what to do with myself next, creatively speaking. My instincts told me it was time to return to my literary roots and write a work of fiction, something I hadn't done in years. In fact, I hadn't written a novel in so long, I feared I had forgotten how to do it at all. I feared that fiction had become a language I could no longer speak. But now I had an idea for a novel, an idea that excited me tremendously. The idea was based on a story that my sweetheart Felipe had told me one night about something that had happened in Brazil back when he was growing up there in the 1960s. Apparently, the Brazilian government got a notion to build a giant highway across the Amazon jungle. This was during an era of rampant development and modernization, and such a scheme must have seemed stupendously forward-thinking at the time. The Brazilians poured a fortune into this ambitious plan. The international development community poured in many more millions. A staggering portion of this money immediately disappeared into a black hole of corruption and disorganization. But eventually enough cash trickled into the right places that the highway project finally began. All was going well for a few months. Progress was being made. A short section of the road was completed. The jungle was being conquered. Then it started to rain. It seems that none of the planners of this project had fully grasped the reality of what the rainy season means in the Amazon. The construction site was immediately inundated and rendered uninhabitable. The crew had no choice but to walk away, leaving behind all their equipment under several feet of water. And when they returned many months later, after the rains had subsided, they discovered to their horror that the jungle had basically devoured their highway project. Their efforts had been erased by nature, as if the laborers and the road had never existed at all. They couldn't even tell where they had been working. All their heavy equipment was missing, too. It had not been stolen. It had simply been swallowed. As Felipe told it, bulldozers with tires as tall as a man had been sucked into the earth and disappeared forever. It was all gone. When he told me this story, especially the part about the jungle swallowing up the machines, chills ran up my arms. The hairs on the back of my neck stood up for an instant, and I felt a little sick, a little dizzy. I felt like I was falling in love or had just heard alarming news or was looking over a precipice at something beautiful and mesmerizing, but dangerous. I'd experienced these symptoms before, so I knew immediately what was going on. Such an intense emotional and physiological reaction doesn't strike me often, but it happens enough and is consistent enough with symptoms reported by people all over the world all throughout history that I believe I can confidently call it by its name. Inspiration. This is what it feels like when an idea comes to you. How ideas work. I should explain at this point that I've spent my entire life in devotion to creativity, and along the way I've developed a set of beliefs about how it works and how to work with it that is entirely and unapologetically based upon magical thinking. And when I refer to magic here, I mean it literally, like in the Hogwarts sense. I am referring to the supernatural, the mystical, the inexplicable, the surreal, the divine, the transcendent, the otherworldly. Because the truth is, I believe that creativity is a force of enchantment, not entirely human in its origins. I am aware this is not an especially modern or rational way of seeing things. It is decidedly unscientific. Just the other day I heard a respected neurologist say in an interview, "The creative process may seem magical, but it is not magic." With all due respect, I disagree. I believe the creative process is both magical and magic. Because here is what I choose to believe about how creativity functions. I believe that our planet is inhabited not only by animals and plants and bacteria and viruses, but also by ideas. Ideas are a disembodied energetic life form. They are completely separate from us, but capable of interacting with us, albeit strangely. Ideas have no material body, but they do have consciousness, and they most certainly have will. Ideas are driven by a single impulse, to be made manifest. And the only way an idea can be made manifest in our world is through collaboration with a human partner. It is only through a human's efforts that an idea can be escorted out of the ether and into the realm of the actual. Therefore, ideas spend eternity swirling around us, searching for available and willing human partners. I'm talking about all ideas here. Artistic, scientific, industrial, commercial, ethical, religious, political. When an idea thinks it has found somebody, say, you, who might be able to bring it into the world, the idea will pay you a visit. It will try to get your attention. Mostly, you will not notice. This is likely because you're so consumed by your own dramas, anxieties, distractions, insecurities, and duties that you aren't receptive to inspiration. You might miss the signal because you're watching TV, or shopping, or brooding over how angry you are at somebody, or pondering your failures and mistakes, or just generally really busy. The idea will try to weigh you down, perhaps for a few moments, perhaps for a few months, perhaps even for a few years. But when it finally realizes that you're oblivious to its message, it will move on to someone else. But sometimes, rarely, but magnificently, there comes a day when you're open and relaxed enough to actually receive something. Your defenses might slacken and your anxieties might ease, and then magic can slip through. The idea sensing your openness will start to do its work on you. It will send the universal physical and emotional signals of inspiration, the chills up the arms, the hair standing up on the back of your neck, the nervous stomach, the buzzy thoughts, that feeling of falling into love or obsession. The idea will organize coincidences and portents to tumble across your path to keep your interest keen. You'll start to notice all sorts of signs pointing you toward the idea. Everything you see and touch and do will remind you of the idea. The idea will wake you up in the middle of the night and distract you from your everyday routine. The idea will not leave you alone until it has your fullest attention. And then, in a quiet moment, it will ask, "Do you want to work with me?" At this point, you have two options for how to respond. What happens when you say no? The simplest answer, of course, is just to say no. Then you're off the hook. The idea will eventually go away, and congratulations, you don't need to bother creating anything. To be clear, this is not always a dishonorable choice. True, you might sometimes decline inspiration's invitation out of laziness, angst, insecurity, or petulance, but other times you might need to say no to an idea because it is truly not the right moment, or because you're already engaged in a different project, or because you're certain that this particular idea has accidentally knocked on the wrong door. I have many times been approached by ideas that I know are not right for me, and I've politely said to them, "I'm honored by your visitation, but I'm not your girl. May I respectfully suggest that you call upon, say, Barbara Kingsolver?" I always try to use my most gracious manners when sending an idea away. You don't want word getting around the universe that you're difficult to work with. Whatever your response, though, do be sympathetic to the poor idea. Remember, all it wants is to be realized. It's trying its best. It seriously has to knock on every door it can. So you might have to say no. When you say no, nothing happens at all. Mostly, people say no. Most of their lives, most people just walk around day after day saying no, 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 no. Then again, someday, you just might say yes. What happens when you say yes? If you do say yes to an idea, now it's showtime. Now your job becomes both simple and difficult. You have officially entered into a contract with inspiration, and you must try to see it through, all the way to its impossible-to-predict outcome. You may set the terms for this contract however you like. In contemporary Western civilization, the most common creative contract still seems to be one of suffering. This is the contract that says, "I shall destroy myself and everyone around me in an effort to bring forth my inspiration, and my martyrdom shall be the badge of my creative legitimacy." If you choose to enter into a contract of creative suffering, you should try to identify yourself as much as possible with the stereotype of the tormented artist. You will find no shortage of role models. To honor their example, follow these fundamental rules. Drink as much as you possibly can, sabotage all your relationships, wrestle so vehemently against yourself that you come up bloodied every time, express constant dissatisfaction with your work, jealously compete against your peers, begrudge anybody else's victories, proclaim yourself cursed, not blessed, by your talents, attach your sense of self-worth to external rewards, be arrogant when you are successful and self-pitying when you fail, honor darkness above light, die young, blame creativity for having killed you. Does it work, this method? Yeah, sure, it works great. Till it kills you. So you can do it this way, if you really want to. By all means, do not let me or anyone else ever take away your suffering if you're committed to it. But I'm not sure this route is especially productive, or that it will bring you or your loved ones enduring satisfaction and peace. I will concede that this method of creative living can be extremely glamorous, and it can make for an excellent biopic after you die. So if you prefer a short life of tragic glamour to a long life of rich satisfaction, and many do, knock yourself out. However, I've always had the sense that the muse of the tormented artist, while the artist himself is throwing temper tantrums, is sitting quietly in the corner of the studio, buffing its fingernails, patiently waiting for the guy to calm down and sober up so everyone can get back to work. Because in the end, it's all about the work, isn't it? Or shouldn't it be? And maybe there's a different way to approach it? May I suggest one? A different way. A different way is to cooperate fully, humbly, and joyfully with inspiration. This is how I believe most people approached creativity for most of history, before we decided to get all la boheme about it. You can receive your ideas with respect and curiosity, not with drama or dread. You can clear out whatever obstacles are preventing you from living your most creative life with the simple understanding that whatever is bad for you is probably also bad for your work. You can lay off the booze a bit in order to have a keener mind. You can nourish healthier relationships in order to keep yourself undistracted by self-invented emotional catastrophes. You can dare to be pleased sometimes with what you have created, and if a project doesn't work out, you can always think of it as having been a worthwhile and constructive experiment. You can resist the seductions of grandiosity, blame, and shame. You can support other people in their creative efforts, acknowledging the truth that there's plenty of room for everyone. You can measure your worth by your dedication to your path, not by your successes or failures. You can battle your demons through therapy, recovery, prayer, or humility, instead of battling your gifts, in part by realizing that your demons were never the ones doing the work anyhow. You can believe that you are neither a slave to inspiration nor its master, but something far more interesting, its partner, and that the two of you are working together towards something intriguing and worthwhile. You can live a long life, making and doing really cool things the entire time. You might earn a living with your pursuits, or you might not, but you can recognize that this is not really the point. And at the end of your days, you can thank creativity for having blessed you with a charmed, interesting, passionate existence. That's another way to do it. Totally up to you. An idea grows. Anyhow, back to my story of magic. Thanks to Felipe's tale about the Amazon, I had been visited by a big idea, to wit, that I should write a novel about Brazil in the 1960s. Specifically, I felt inspired to write a novel about the efforts to build that ill-fated highway across the jungle. This idea seemed epic and thrilling to me. It was also daunting. What the hell did I know about the Brazilian Amazon or road construction in the 1960s? But all the good ideas feel daunting at first, so I proceeded. I agreed to enter into a contract with the idea. We would work together. We shook hands on it, so to speak. I promised the idea that I would never fight against it and never abandon it, but I would only cooperate with it to the utmost of my ability until our work together was done. I then did what you do when you get serious about a project or a pursuit. I cleared space for it. I cleaned off my desk, literally and figuratively. I committed myself to several hours of research every morning. I made myself go to bed early so I could get up at dawn and be ready for work. I said no to alluring distractions and social invitations so I could focus on my job. I ordered books about Brazil and I placed calls to experts. I started studying Portuguese. I bought index cards, my preferred method of keeping track of notes, and I allowed myself to begin dreaming of this new world. And in that space, more ideas began to arrive, and the outlines of the story started to take shape. I decided that the heroine of my novel would be a middle-aged American woman named Evelyn. It is the late 1960s, a time of great political and cultural upheaval, but Evelyn is living a quiet life, as she always has done, in central Minnesota. She's a spinster who has spent 25 years working capably as an executive secretary at a large Midwestern highway construction firm. During that entire time, Evelyn has been quietly and hopelessly in love with her married boss, a kind, hard-working man who never sees Evelyn as anything but an efficient assistant. The boss has a son, a shady fellow with big ambitions. The son hears about this giant highway project going on down in Brazil and persuades his father to put in a bid. The son uses his charm and coercion to convince the father to throw the family's entire fortune behind this enterprise. Soon enough, the son heads down to Brazil with a great deal of money and wild dreams of glory. Quickly, both the son and the money vanish. Bereft, the father dispatches Evelyn, his most trusted ambassador, to go to the Amazon to try to recover the missing young man and the missing cash. Out of a sense of duty and love, Evelyn heads to Brazil, at which point her orderly and unremarkable life is overturned as she enters into a world of chaos, lies, and violence. Drama and epiphanies follow. Also, it's a love story. I decided I would call the novel Evelyn of the Amazon. I wrote a proposal for the book and sent it to my publishing company. They liked it and they bought it. Now I entered into a second contract with the idea. A formal contract this time, with notarized signatures and deadlines and everything. Now I was fully invested. I got to work in earnest. An idea gets sidetracked. A few months later, however, real-life drama derailed me from my pursuit of invented drama. On a routine trip to America, my sweetheart Felipe was detained by a border agent and denied entry to the United States. He had done nothing wrong, but the Department of Homeland Security put him in jail anyway, and then threw him out of the country. We were informed that Felipe could never again come to America, unless we got married. Moreover, if I wanted to be with my love during this stressful and indefinite period of exile, I would have to pack up my entire life immediately and go join him overseas. This, I promptly did, and I stayed abroad with him for almost a year as we dealt with our drama and our immigration paperwork. Such upheaval does not make for the ideal environment in which to devote oneself to writing a sprawling and heavily researched novel about the Brazilian Amazon in the 1960s. Therefore, I put Evelyn away, with sincere promises that I would return to her later, as soon as stability was restored to my life. I put all my existing notes for that novel into storage, along with the rest of my belongings, and then I flew halfway across the planet to be with Felipe and to work on solving our mess. And because I must always be writing about something, or else I will go mad, I decided to write about that. That is, to chronicle what was going on in my real life as a way of sorting through its complications and revelations. As Joan Didion said, "I don't know what I think until I write about it." Over time, this experience grew into my memoir, Committed. I want to make clear that I do not regret having written Committed. I'm forever grateful to that book, as the process of writing it helped me to sort out my extreme anxiety about my impending marriage. But that book commanded my attention for quite a long while, and by the time it was done, more than 2 years had passed. More than 2 years that I had not spent working on Evelyn of the Amazon. That's a long time to leave an idea unattended. I was eager to get back to it. So once Felipe and I were safely married and settled back home in the U.S., and once Committed was finished, I retrieved all my notes out of storage and sat down at my new desk in my new house, ready to recommence crafting my novel about the Amazon jungle. Right away, however, I made a most distressing discovery. My novel was gone. An idea goes away. Allow me to explain. I do not mean to say that somebody had stolen my notes or that a crucial computer file had gone missing. What I mean is that the living heart of my novel was gone. The sentient force that inhabits all vibrant creative endeavors had vanished. Swallowed like bulldozers in the jungle, you could say. Sure, all the research and writing I'd completed 2 years earlier was still there, but I knew at once that I was looking at nothing but the empty husk of what had once been a warm and pulsating entity. I'm pretty stubborn about sticking with projects, so I prodded at the thing for several months, trying to make it work again, hoping to bring it back to life. But it was useless. Nothing was there. It was like poking a stick at a cast-off snakeskin. The more I messed with it, the faster it fell apart and turned to dust. I believed I knew what had happened because I'd seen this sort of thing before. The idea had grown tired of waiting, and it had left me. I could scarcely blame it. I had, after all, broken our contract. I'd promised to dedicate myself completely to Evelyn of the Amazon, and then I'd reneged on that promise. I hadn't given the book a moment's attention for more than 2 years. What was the idea supposed to do? Sit around indefinitely while I ignored it? Maybe. Sometimes they do wait. Some exceedingly patient ideas might wait years or even decades for your attention. But others won't, because each idea has a different nature. Would you sit around in a box for 2 years while your collaborator blew you off? Probably not. Thus, the neglected idea did what many self-respecting living entities would do in the same circumstances. It hit the road. Fair enough, right? Because this is the other side of the contract with creativity. If inspiration is allowed to unexpectedly enter you, it is also allowed to unexpectedly exit you. If I'd been younger, the loss of Evelyn of the Amazon might have knocked me off my feet. But by this point in my life, I'd been in the game of imagination long enough to let it go without excessive struggle. I could have wept over the loss, but I didn't, because I understood the terms of the deal, and I accepted those terms. I understood that the best you can hope for in such a situation is to let your old idea go and catch the next idea that comes around. And the best way for that to happen is to move on swiftly, with humility and grace. Don't fall into a funk about the one that got away. Don't beat yourself up. Don't rage at the gods above. All that is nothing but distraction, and the last thing you need is further distraction. Grieve if you must, but grieve efficiently. Better to just say goodbye to the lost idea with dignity and continue onward. Find something else to work on, anything, immediately, and get at it. Keep busy. Most of all, be ready. Keep your eyes open. Listen. Follow your curiosity. Ask questions. Sniff around. Remain open. Trust in the miraculous truth that new and marvelous ideas are looking for human collaborators every single day. Ideas of every kind are constantly galloping toward us, constantly passing through us, constantly trying to get our attention. Let them know you're available. And for heaven's sake, try not to miss the next one. Wizardry. This should be the end of my Amazon jungle story, but it isn't. Just around the same time that the idea for my new novel ran away, it was now 2008, I made a new friend, Ann Patchett, the celebrated novelist. We met one afternoon in New York City on a panel discussion about libraries. Yes, that's right, a panel discussion about libraries. The life of a writer is endlessly glamorous. I was instantly intrigued by Anne, not only because I'd always admired her work, but because she is a rather remarkable presence in person. Anne has a preternatural ability to render herself very small, nearly invisible, in order to better observe the world around her in safe anonymity, so that she can write about it unnoticed. In other words, her superpower is to conceal her superpowers. When I first met Anne, then, it is probably not surprising that I didn't immediately recognize her as the famous author. She looked so unassuming and tiny and young that I thought she was somebody's assistant, perhaps even somebody's assistant's assistant. Then I put it together who she was. I thought, my goodness, she's so meek. But I had been fooled. An hour later, Miss Patchett stood up at the lectern and gave one of the most robust and dazzling speeches I've ever heard. She rocked that room, and she rocked me. That's when I realized that this woman was, in fact, quite tall and strong and gorgeous and passionate and brilliant. It was as if she'd thrown off her invisibility cloak, and a full-on goddess stepped forth. I was transfixed. I'd never seen anything quite like this complete transformation of presence from one moment to the next. And because I have no boundaries, I ran up to her after the event and clutched her by the arm, eager to catch this amazing creature before she dematerialized into invisibility again. I said, Anne, I realize that we've only just met, but I have to tell you, you're extraordinary, and I love you. Now, Anne Patchett is a woman who actually does have boundaries. She looked at me a bit askance, unsurprisingly. She seemed to be deciding something about me. For a moment, I wasn't sure where I stood. But what she did next was wonderful. She cupped my face in her hands and kissed me. Then she pronounced, "And I love you, Liz Gilbert." In that instant, a friendship was ignited. The terms of our friendship were to be somewhat unusual, though. Anne and I don't live in the same area. I'm in New Jersey, she's in Tennessee. So it wasn't as if we would be able to meet once a week for lunch. Neither of us is a big fan of talking on the phone, either. Nor was social media the place for this relationship to grow. Instead, we decided to get to know each other through the all-but-lost art of letter writing. In a tradition that continues to this day, Anne and I began writing each other long, thoughtful letters every month, real letters, on real paper with envelopes and postage and everything. It is a rather antiquated way to be friends with someone, but we are both rather antiquated people. We write about our marriages, our families, our friendships, our frustrations, but mostly we write about writing. Which is how it came to pass that in the autumn of 2008, Anne casually mentioned in a letter that she had recently begun working on a new novel and that it was about the Amazon jungle. For obvious reasons, that caught my attention. I wrote back and asked Anne what her novel was about more specifically. I explained that I, too, had been working on an Amazon jungle novel, but that mine had gotten away from me because I'd neglected it, a state of affairs that I knew she would understand. In her next letter, Anne replied that it was too soon yet to know precisely what her jungle novel was about. Early days still. The story was just taking shape. She would keep me informed as it all evolved. The following February, Anne and I met in person for only the second time in our lives. We were to appear together on stage at an event in Portland, Oregon. The morning of our appearance, we shared breakfast in the hotel's cafe. Anne told me that she was now deep into the writing of her new book, more than 100 pages in. I said, "Okay, now you really do have to tell me what your Amazon novel is about. I've been dying to know." "You go first," she said, "since your book was first. You tell me what your Amazon jungle novel was about, the one that got away." I tried to summarize my ex-novel as concisely as possible. I said, "It was about this middle-aged spinster from Minnesota who's been quietly in love with her married boss for many years. He gets involved in a harebrained business scheme down in the Amazon jungle. A bunch of money and a person go missing, and my character gets sent down there to solve things, at which point her quiet life is completely turned into chaos. Also, it's a love story." Anne stared at me from across the table for a long minute. Before I continue, I must give you to understand that, decidedly unlike myself, Anne Patchett is a true lady. She has exquisite manners. There is nothing vulgar or coarse about her, which made it even more shocking when she finally spoke. "You have got to be fucking kidding me." "Why?" I asked. "What's your novel about?" She replied, "It's about a spinster from Minnesota who's been quietly in love with her married boss for many years. He gets involved in a harebrained business scheme down in the Amazon jungle. A bunch of money and a person go missing, and my character is sent down there to solve things, at which point her quiet life is completely turned into chaos. Also, it's a love story." WTF. That is not a genre, people. That storyline is not a Scandinavian murder mystery or a vampire romance. That is an extremely specific storyline. You cannot just go to the bookstore and ask the sales clerk to direct you to the section devoted to books about middle-aged Minnesota spinsters in love with their married bosses who get sent down to the Amazon jungle to find missing people and save doomed projects. That is not a thing. Admittedly, when we broke it all down to finer details, there were some differences. My novel took place in the 1960s while Anne's was contemporary. My book had been about the highway construction business while hers was about the pharmaceutical industry. But other than that, they were the same book. As you might imagine, it took Anne and me a while to recover our composure after this revelation. Then, like pregnant women eager to recall the exact moment of conception, we each counted backward on our fingers, trying to determine when I had lost the idea and when she had found it. Turns out, those events had occurred around the same time. In fact, we think the idea might have been officially transmitted on the day we met. In fact, we think it was exchanged in the kiss. And that, my friends, is big magic. A little perspective. Now, before we get too excited, I want to pause for a moment and ask you to consider all the negative conclusions that I could have drawn about this incident had I been in the mood to ruin my life. The worst and most destructive conclusion I could have drawn was that Anne Patchett had stolen my idea. That would have been absurd, of course, because Anne had never even heard of my idea, and besides, she's the single most ethical human being I've ever met close up. But people do draw hateful conclusions like this all the time. People convince themselves that they have been robbed when they have